I would like to welcome you all this evening to the 2009 Bernard A. Osher Lecture, and as always, I would like to extend my very heartfelt thanks to the Osher family for endowing this extraordinary annual event in our community. Our winter exhibition, Backstage Pass, Rock and Roll Photography, opened last week to extraordinary success. Attendance on this first past weekend of the show exceeded last year by exactly 100%. Thank you to our media sponsors, The Phoenix, Jeff Inglis is here, Channel 6, and WBLM. Thank you. And without further ado, I would like to introduce Dana Baldwin, the Peggy L. Osher Director of Education at the Portland Museum of Art, who will introduce our distinguished speaker tonight, a writer and critic who has literally shaped the way we look at and listen to our world, Greil Marcus. Dana.
There's a big yellow sign on the microphone that says, "Don't touch button." So here I go. Thank you all for joining us this evening. I'm Dana Baldwin. I'm the Peggy L. Osher Director of Education at the museum. So pleased to see such a hearty crowd here for tonight's program on such a cold night. And tonight we hear from Greil Marcus, our distinguished guest who has come from California to visit us in Maine. You know, it couldn't be on Thursday when it's going to be all of 29 degrees. It has to be today when it's all of 1 or whatever it was. Greil Marcus' books, Mystery Train, Lipstick Traces and Others, redefined the parameters of rock criticism. He's been a rock critic and columnist for Cream, The Village Voice, a columnist for Art Forum, and of course, he was there at the beginning of Rolling Stone, that oh-so-important magazine to so many of our histories with rock and roll, as the first records editor, Rolling Stone magazine in 1979, where he, according to Wikipedia, made a whopping $30 per week. And I did have the chance to confirm the accuracy of Wikipedia with Greil this afternoon, and unfortunately, not everything on Wikipedia is exactly true, because Greil corrected it and let me know that it was actually $35 a week that he made for when he was working for Rolling Stone. Greil is generously offered to sign books at the Portland Museum of Art following this lecture, so I hope after his talk you'll join us in the museum's Great Hall. There are some light refreshments, copies of many of the books that Greil Marcus has written, as well as copies of the exhibition's catalog for Backstage Pass, for which Greil wrote a really wonderful introduction. So I invite everyone to get in line behind me at the book signing as I'm giving everybody that I know that is a rock and roll fan, especially the men in my life, are all getting signed copies of the Backstage Pass catalog after tonight. So I will step aside and hope to see you all again at the book signing in the museum's Great Hall. And until then, we're ready to rock and roll with Greil Marcus. Let's join me in welcoming him.
Thank you all for coming. It's a wonderful crowd. But since neither Dana or Tom performed the ritual that has to be performed before any talk of this sort, I have to ask you all to turn off your phones. The last time I gave a talk where Tom was present, my phone went off 3 times. So I know what it's like to have that, to, you know, interrupt oneself. So, the exhibition, Backstage Pass, it's drawn from the archives of a single anonymous collector. And the show was put together with his involvement. So both the show and the collection reflect this person's interest, this person's aesthetics, his favorites, his eye. There's no attempt in this collection to capture the whole expanse of rock and roll music, rock and roll excess, moments of rock and roll contemplation, rock and roll performance. The show, in its way, is a version of walking through the hallways of a private house and looking at what the person who lives there has put on his walls. So I'm going to talk tonight about what's in the show and what isn't. And first I'm going to talk about, well, I will if I have a little more light. I have suddenly been plunged into darkness. And unlike Governor David Patterson, I have not memorized my talk. That's better. Thank you. First, I want to talk about backstage, offstage, and intimacy. Now, the picture that's been up as you came in, the picture that's in front of us now, this is an iconic image. This is an image that seems called forth by rock and roll itself. And you can imagine that the very presence of a photographer called it into being. You can imagine him saying, okay, act like rock stars. This is a picture by Kate Simon. It's backstage in Birmingham. But I like a caption that this photo once carried in an anonymous book called Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And the caption is, who sound man Bob Pridden forces Ronnie Van Zant to drink alcohol? At the Lynyrd Skynyrd end of tour party, 1974. I love this picture. I've loved it since I first saw it. And it is just wonderfully hung at the exhibition. Most of the pictures at the exhibition are pretty good size. This is very small. And you have to look at it. And it's almost like an image that draws your attention because it's so small. You look at it hard. Kind of sucks you into it. Well, this is a version of backstage rock and roll life that I think everyone carries in his or her head, whether they've been there or not. But I want to show you another image. Can we have the next one? In 1956, Albert Wertheimer became the first journalist ever granted complete access to Elvis Presley, and he will die as the last person ever granted complete access. I met him a couple of years ago in Paris at an exhibition called Rock and Roll 39 to 59 at the Cartier Foundation, the most thrilling historical museum exhibit I've ever seen. And I was thrilled to have the chance to talk to him. And of course, you know, he followed Elvis from New York to Memphis on a train, through many concerts. He was with him all the time. He took pictures of him playing a portable record player on the train, combing his hair, performing. His favorite shot was of Elvis running across a field. The train had pulled in to Memphis, way outside of the station. It had stopped for some reason. Elvis simply jumped off the train and ran across the field to his parents' house. It's just the most remarkable picture. So I asked him about this picture. He said, well, this is part of a whole series of shots, almost a dozen, that he took of this girl and Elvis. She was asking everybody, Wertheimer included, can you get me to Elvis? Can you get me to Elvis? Well, somehow she got to Elvis. And they're backstage. They're offstage. They're in a stairwell. And they've been climbing up and down the stairwell. They've been feeling each other out, taking each other's measure. And Wertheimer said that at first Elvis would look over his shoulder and kind of wink at him, you know, you got a good one here. He said, after a while, he completely forgot about me. The girl had completely become his world, and he was interested in absolutely nothing else. This is a picture that you will never see anywhere else. You will never see Elvis Presley as completely himself, as completely thrilled by the person he's suddenly become, as you will here. And yet, it's also a picture that everyone has lived out. Everyone may not have lived out that backstage picture of Ronnie Van Zant, but we've all had moments like this. We can't look away from this picture. We may feel like voyeurs. We've all had this moment, but none of us, I'm sure, ever thought when we had these moments it would enter into history as this one has. Let's look at the next picture. This is far off stage. This is a picture taken by Lou Allen. He was 19 years old in Rochester, New York in 1958. There's Buddy Holly. A week from tomorrow will be the 50th anniversary of his death in a plane crash outside of Clear Lake, Iowa. There's Buddy Holly. There's the Crickets drummer, Jerry Allison, who really did marry Peggy Sue. And there's Sue Shepherd of the Shepherd Sisters. Now, there's a different kind of intimacy here. It's a closed and quiet world. We're on the bus. They're riding the bus. They're tired. They're bored. But mostly, they're really tired. Their guard is all the way down. But the intimacy in this picture is that we know where this bus is going, and they don't. We know how the story told in this picture turns out. We know how it ends. And we know how valuable, how precious, how unique this moment is, and they don't. Now, I want to talk about an aspect of this show that you don't normally associate with rock and roll, and that's reserve and dignity. Let's look at the next picture. This is from 1960. It's taken by the great jazz photographer William Claxton. He died last October. He was 80 years old. This is John Coltrane standing in front of a Robert Motherwell painting in the Guggenheim in New York. He had 7 years to live. A Love Supreme was 2 years ahead of him. On the cover of that album, he looks much older than he does in this picture. He looks like a hard-working man. But I can't begin to see into this picture. The self-possession here is absolute. You don't dare to bother this person. You're not going to go up to him and say, "I'm your biggest fan." You're not going to go up to him and tug on his coat and say, "You changed my life." And if you did do that, I can imagine that he would say what the film critic Manny Farber, who died last year at 91, can imagine what Manny Farber once said when a film student came up to him and said, "Mr. Farber, you changed my life." And he said, "I doubt it." We'll look at the next picture. This is a picture by Emile Cadou from 1960. This is Edith Piaf. She had 2 years to live. She could be a woman begging on the street with that hand out. And what's she asking for? Whatever it might be, the way she holds herself, the look on her face says, "I've paid for what I'm asking for many times over." We'll look at the next picture. This is Philip Townsend, 1961. That's the date the catalog says, but I think it's probably later. The Rolling Stones, as the Rolling Stones, didn't play their first show until the summer of 1962. They called themselves the Rolling Stones because they were blues purists. And they named themselves after Muddy Waters, one of his first recordings, Rolling Stone, from 1950. And here, they're acting like blues people. They're serious. They're talking something over. It matters. It might simply be what song they're going to play after their third song at their next show. Who knows what they're talking about? They're holding themselves in reserve. And again, it's a picture that you won't interrupt. You're not going to bother them either. Let's look at the next picture. This again is by William Claxton, but it's just from last year. It appeared in the frontispiece of Bob Dylan's book, Drawn Blank, his collection of watercolors. And it's a picture of permanence. You sense that both the photographer's eye and in the eye of the subject that they've seen almost everything there is to see. But they're still thinking it over. They're trying to figure it out. There's no hurry in this picture. This person is going to be around. And it's reminiscent of nothing so much as a portrait of Charlie Patton, was born in 1891. He died in 1934. Picture was taken about 1930. He was the first great master of the Mississippi Blues. He's one of Bob Dylan's heroes. For years, there was only one shot of him that was known, and it was a picture of extraordinary presence, menacing almost in the, again, the self-possession of this man, but it was only a headshot. And forever, that was the only picture. Just a few years ago, someone discovered that there was actually a body that went with the head. The whole picture. This is Charlie Patton sitting in an enormous chair, almost like a throne. He's wearing a suit that's so beautiful, it shines through the black and white. And he's got spats on his feet. Well, Bob Dylan's son, Jacob Dylan's band, The Wallflowers, had a song a few years ago where Jacob Dylan sings, "Sam Cooke didn't know the things that I know." This picture seems to be saying, I think now, after all these years, I know some of the things Charlie Patton knew. It's a picture that passes dignity on to whoever looks at it. We'll look at the next picture. This is about 1965. This is Dusty Springfield. Her great album, Dusty in Memphis, was 4 years ahead of her. And like John Coltrane, she wraps the air around herself. She makes a place for herself in the world, and there's no room for anybody else. Now I want to talk just for a moment about something that's close to dignity, but it's not the same, and that's cool. And it's much harder to capture in a photograph. And what is it anyway? What is cool? Let's look at the next picture. Again, William Claxton, 1958. Tony Bennett. Is cool not having a care in the world? Look at the next picture. This is, again, Philip Townsend from 1963. This is Andrew Loog Oldham. I always thought Loog was a name that he made up for himself, kind of like Droog and Clockwork Orange, some really scary name. Turns out to be a family name. I have no idea what kind of family would have people that would walk around, "Hi, I'm Mr. Loog." Oh, you know, enough of that. This is Andrew Loog Oldham. He's 19 years old. He's the manager of the Rolling Stones. He's younger than anybody in the band. The picture that you see above his hands is tacked to the wall. But he's holding his hands as if he's holding the picture, as he's just suspending it in the air. He's holding the picture of his boys over his head as if they're pawns, and he can do with them whatever he likes. He can throw it up into the air and see where it lands. Maybe cool is not caring about anything in the world. That's what I see in this picture. Now, I want to walk away from the exhibition, but I'm going to go back to it every once in a while. I want to follow my own eye. I want to talk about Rolling Stone, when it first started. The first staff photographer at Rolling Stone was Baron Woolman. And there was something absolutely singular about his best work. What Baron seemed to want to do, what he did do, was not to capture the essence of a performer, not his or her inner being, but the gravity of his subject. Let's look at the next picture. That's Pete Townsend. Look at the next one. B.B. King. The next one. Johnny Cash. These are all Baron Woolman. They're all taken in San Francisco in 1967. At Rolling Stone in the late 60s, there was a sense of mission. There was a great story to be told, the story of rock and roll, and it was up to the people at the magazine to tell it. Nobody else was going to get it right. There was a sense of high stakes. There was a sense that the work being done, maybe especially the visual work, was going to last. It deserved to last. It ought to last if there was any decency in the world. It would last if we could make our own history and make it stick. Making a photographic record of what was happening then was a lot of what making history stick was about. You find an image, you make an image that is not going to go away. It's just going to have too much weight. That's how it worked. And you can see that sense of act of the subject himself breaking into the stream of time and events to say, wait a minute, pause, watch, listen, as long as it takes for the moment to sink in. Can we go back to the picture of Pete Townsend? It was number 11. This picture especially speaks to me that way. Now, Baron Wolman caught an instant, a gesture on its way to something else. But that's not how the picture communicates. That's not what it says. It says, I will stand here with my wings spread until I no longer feel the need to do so. And I'm betting I can stop you cold, wondering what's next, if anything is. That sense of history, history being made, history yet to be made, history to insist on, is something I think that's missing in the exhibition. It's not that Baron Wolman is missing. There's a color picture of Janis Joplin by him in the exhibition. But what the collector wanted from Baron Wolman is not what I want. One of the things that made pictures communicate, that made the history they carried stick in Rolling Stone, was the size of the magazine. Well, we called it a paper in those days. And it was Robert Kingsbury, the art director, and his idea of what to do with pictures. Before he showed up, pictures were scattered through the pages almost randomly. And they were small. And you missed whatever they carried. They were illustrations. They illustrated the article they were part of. But they didn't speak for themselves. And Kingsbury had a different kind of eye. He would take a single picture and he would cover the entire page with it, and the pages were big. This is one. He chose the faces that he blew up to that size on the basis of how they looked, not their celebrity. Sometimes he would choose a face simply because he liked the shape of somebody's head. And that's how it worked. Let's look at the next picture. This was an entire page of Rolling Stone. Somebody no one reading the magazine had ever heard of. This is Nathan Beauregard. He was identified in the magazine as 106 years old. I don't know if that's true. Let's look at the next picture. There's Fred McDowell. That is maybe the best picture that Baron Wolman ever took. A picture of peace, of knowledge, of ease, of weight, dignity, gravity, saying, you can come up and tell me I changed your life anytime you like. A welcoming picture. Now, I want to talk about ordinariness and aura. I want to talk about the way that rock and roll provides a field for the most ordinary people to become, maybe for just a moment, or maybe just to seem extraordinary. This, is, again, is something that's not... I'm going to have to go to a band that is not featured in the exhibition, that is not included in the illustrated histories of rock and roll, that is not included in the unillustrated histories of rock and roll. I'm going to go back to a review the rock critic Lester Bangs wrote in 1972 for the magazine Cream, where he was the music editor and the all-day, all-night writer. It's a review of the first album by White Witch. This was an outfit that was trying to find its footing in the swirling new pop world where nothing was what it used to be. A marketplace that was suddenly redefined by the likes of David Bowie, where everything was costumes and lipstick and mascara and pose and platform shoes. But everybody's done that. They have to take it further. So they're going to be White Witch, and they're going to cast spells. And I will never forget a publicist saying to me, insisting as if he really cared, "Don't worry, they're into good magic, not bad magic. You see, White Witch." So here are these guys who, in Lester's words, would much rather be singing about, "Come on, little honey, puff this joint of mine, and you'll see things differently," but no, that's passé. Now he says they're trading in cosmic, mystic, occult, jujube, ragas, mumbo, jumbo, Merlin, mush. As observe, Lester says, observe the dork standing on the left. But I think any of them will fill this role. He says, it is ineluctable fact that beneath all that makeup, silk, Beelzebeads, and hoodoo voodoo drag, yes, lies a true dork. But he could be standing in a gray, thin-lapelled suit on a surf band album a decade ago. The next picture. Or he could be nervous under a brand new beetle pudding bowl halfway between then and now. And here we have the dork with the Beatles. This is Jimmy Nicol, one of the most forgotten figures in all of rock and roll. There came a time in 1964 when the Beatles were booked to play Australia, but Ringo had tonsillitis. And they got this guy to fill in for just a week. And there he was, a Beatle himself. And does he look out of place? Lester goes on. He could be nervous under a... He could be standing in his Nehru jacket with a New Delhi tourist throw rug hanging on the wall behind him a year or two later, or sullenly spaced out behind a heavy blues guitar in 1968. The next picture. Led Zeppelin, Bob Grun. Well, Lester says, the great tradition never dies. So here he is now, and we'll look at White Witch again, made up like an acid transvestite. And not only is his masculinity not compromised a whit, he's unmistakably that same dork, the one that used to sit next to you in driver training and fart all the time. And the rest of the band is no different. And yet, here's another band, unquestionably made up of exactly the same people. The next picture. And some of these people I actually did go to school with, although I didn't take driver training with them. Here's The Grateful Dead by the San Francisco photographer Herb Green, about 1965. Guitarist Bob Weir, holding his hand up high, was 2 years behind me at Menlo Atherton High School in Atherton, California. Drummer Bill Kreutzmann was a year behind me at Peninsula School in Menlo Park. Kreutzmann I knew well enough not to know the person in this picture. He was a withdrawn kid. He was quiet. He was unhappy. People whispered that his parents were divorced, which in the California suburbs in the 1950s was still a scandal. You just didn't hear about that sort of thing. So who's this person? Who's this person in the front with the short hair? Who's this person who's holding himself with a sense of ease and confidence? He's handsome. He's unafraid. Something has changed him. And this is a picture of that. This is a picture of rock and roll changing somebody, letting him be a different person than people have always expected him to be. And there's a hint here of aura. And what is aura exactly? The German critic Walter Benjamin wrote a little essay in 1930 called A Short History of Photography. And he answered himself as he asked, what is an aura exactly? He said, it's a weaving of space and time. It has the unique appearance of a distance, no matter how close it may be. Where does aura come from? How do you weave that web of space and time? In 1965, Herb Green had a wall painted with hieroglyphics, and he posed all the figures of the San Francisco rock and roll scene against that wall, every single one. We'll look at the next picture. Now, this is Bill Graham. And even with this unglamorous person, whose face flatly tells you that there's no mystery to who he is, the symbols around him insist that there is a mystery. Something of that web of space and time is just being in the right place at the right time. And then there are those who weave their own space and time. They weave their own aura. Here's Bob Dylan in a car, turned away. That distance is palpable, no matter how close it might be. No matter how close that photographer is going to get to this person, he could be miles away. He'll never be closer than that. This is by Barry Feinstein, 1965. We'll look at the next picture. The intensity in this picture is frightening. It's more frightening than the spooky person in the penumbra of hair who seems to be hiding even when he's looking you in the face. This is an aura, that was an aura that Cate Blanchett was able to capture in Todd Haynes' movie, I'm Not There, just by tilting her head in a certain squinty way. But this is something else. Here's Bob Dylan looking right at you, and he's not hiding. He has not wrapped anything around himself. This is a white-hot power source, something you shouldn't touch. And the person, this is the person who emerges when Cate Blanchett says to an interviewer, impatient and angry, when the interviewer says, have you turned your back on the music of the people, on folk music? And Cate Blanchett says with such irritation, with such hurriedness, you know, I never cared about it. I never cared about it. That was just something I knew I could do better than anybody else. And that's what you're seeing here. That's something Bob Dylan actually said, and in a way, he's saying it here before he even did any of it. This is by John Cohen. It's 1962. Those words are waiting to be said. He's got them in his head. He sees his history ahead of him. Look at the next picture. Now here in this picture of Johnny Rotten by Dennis Morris, 1977, you can't tell if the aura is the work of a photographer determined to put a devil's halo on his subject's head, or if it's something Johnny Rotten is squeezing out of his own forehead. But you can't deny it. Now, just about half, maybe 90%, of all rock and roll photography is performance photography. And that's something that maybe with one or two exceptions is explicitly not part of the Backstage Pass exhibition. And you can see why, even more than posed rock and roll pictures, the band. Even more than that, rock and roll performance photography has become so completely encased in its own cliches that no aura is possible, no individuality, nothing that hasn't been said and seen before, no posture. There's no posture anyone can assume that isn't borrowed, that isn't secondhand, that person doesn't already know. There's no mystery in it. But I want to look at people struggling to escape from that trap. I want to find the opposite of this prison of cliches. People, performers struggling to escape it, and a photographer struggling to escape it. So in pictures that aren't in the exhibition, we're going to go back to the Mabuhay Gardens in San Francisco in 1978. It was the main punk club in San Francisco, an old Filipino nightclub that had been taken over by a booker who drove out the old patrons and brought in new ones. It's the work of a photographer named Bruce Conner, who died last year at the age of 74. He was a great artist. He was a painter. He was a sculptor. He was an engraver. He was a collagist. He was an assemblage artist. He was a movie maker. There's no limit to what he did. He was the sort of person who made art by walking down the street. He worked with what other people called found objects, but he always called them lost objects. He found them, but what was really interesting was that someone else had lost them. A friend called him up one night in 1978 and said, "You've got to get down to the Mabuhay Gardens." He said, "What's the Mabuhay Gardens?" She said, it's this club on Broadway, the most wonderful band. You've got to see them. You've got to get down here tonight." The band was Devo. So he went down, and he conceived a project. "I'll start at the beginning of the year," he said in 2005, "and I'll photograph for a year. I'll do a document. I'll do a document of what happened in that period of time, what changes take place, the geography of the Mabuhay Gardens, inside and out, and the different transformations of people. I'll do a document of an environment." He started on January 3rd, 1978, with a Canon reflex. "The first night I'm there photographing the Avengers," he said. He said again in 2005, "and I'm up front with my knee pads, and the stage was shin high, so I'm always damaged. And I had to protect my camera. Jimmy Woolsey, the Avengers bass player, he would just jam his guitar into my lens, and I'd move back. And I'd move forward, and he'd head toward me. And if I didn't move, he would have destroyed my camera. And I always liked the idea," he said, "I liked the idea of action photography, sports photography, basketball photography. You've got these guys floating in air, and they have these beatific looks on their face, or their faces are filled with anguish. Well, really," he said, "it's combat photography. That's what I wanted to do." In Conner's pictures, you can see all of these ambitions realized. Let's look at the next picture. This is Will Shatter in the band Negative Trend, January 29th, 1978. He had 9 years to live. He's rising out of smoke as if he's being born from it, fully formed, all concentration, all focus. The world around him seems to have fallen away. "This is not a showbiz effect," Conner said. "Someone threw a smoke bomb on the stage. The smoke came up, and Will walked through it. And you can actually see his shadow on the cloud." What Conner realized was that to get what he wanted, if he were to escape the box of rock and roll performance, the box that rock and roll builds around performance, he had to get a band before it had any idea of what it was doing, or even what it was. He was a 43-year-old punk photographer, and that idea was punk. "There was always a certain tension," Conner said, "just because it's the first show at that venue, maybe, or maybe it's the first show they've ever played ever. They were doing something new, so they hadn't codified it. They hadn't got it rehearsed. They weren't bored with it. They would go off, things would go off in directions that they would never do again. And the band would disband. They wouldn't be there anymore. That's what I had to be there to capture. Anything could happen, and the stakes could rise to the ceiling and break through it. That's when the paradox between the silence of photographs and the noise that Connor was photographing is at its most fierce. Something that's most overwhelming in Connor's photographs of D-Detroit. D-Detroit, that's where she was from. The singer of UXA, which stood for United Experiments of America. This picture is from July 10th, 1978, and the Babuhe. We'll look at the next picture. Small, pretty blonde woman, D.D. appears first standing straight up at the microphone, held to her mouth, wrapped in gauze. It's 1 week after her boyfriend died of a drug overdose. Her face is shrouded. Her body is almost completely erased. Connor says she slowly became unveiled behind the gauze, he remembered. She was reborn symbolically for her. It was her way of dealing with grieving and the view that there is a rebirth of some sort. But what I see in this picture is nothing so acceptable. As a drama, it's a tragedy. It's a punk Oedipus. And as a tragedy, it's a B-movie horror story. As Oedipus, D.D. Detroit is also Boris Karloff in The Mummy. We'll look at the next picture. You're ahead of me. Let's go back. Back again. We'll hold there. Here her head is thrown back and the drama is doubled and it's doubled again. Now she's Sarah Bernhardt in Phaedra in 1894. Or she's Theda Bara in Camille in 1917. Or Nazimova as Camille in 1921, or Garbo in 1937. And it's the fact that the way that D. Detroit holds herself is received, a set of gestures that brings the whole weight of the past to bear. That's what freezes this picture as you look. And then in the next picture, with the white cloth hanging over her left arm and pulling against her legs as if it has its own will, Dee Dee is less symbolically reborn than she's symbolically naked. Even her eyes, visible for the first time, look as if they, no less than Oedipus's eyes, have been gouged out. It's as if you can see all the way through her to the other side. And now the past is gone. She's on her own. The next picture. There's nothing left. People pulling at her legs. It's impossible to know what they're doing. Connor couldn't remember if they were pulling her off stage, if they were holding her in place, if they had come up and simply wanted to lay their hands on her. There's no way of telling. This is great drama, but perhaps Connor's ambitions were realized more in two pictures of Teresa Sauter, a teenage singer of a band called The Situations. We'll look at the next picture. She seems to be made out of light. She seems not to know where she is. A princess transported from another world to find herself on the stage of the rattiest club in town with people from all over waiting for her to do something. Look at the next picture. There's a mystery, Connor said, looking into Sauter's eyes in his own print of the picture. Sometimes you couldn't figure out what was going on. Is this really a drama someplace that's not on stage at the Mabuhay? The look in Sauter's eyes is a fairy tale look. This is a woman who used to be a swan. She's escaped from her swan body, but the demon has caught up with her, and she's about to be returned to it. Now, all photographs insist on their unreality, in their silence. They're not life. They're not live. They're not a documentary of an event as it unfolds. All photography, all photographs, are a photographer's or an editor's choice of what you ought to see and how you ought to see it. Is that in that gap between what appears to be life and what patently isn't, is the sense of mystery that powers the photographs that we remember. Whether they're family snapshots, whether they're Julia Margaret Cameron's pictures of the great Victorians, But some photographs insist on that silence, heightening that gap between, as if they're daring the world to remember. Let's look at the next picture. This is by Laura Levine in 1988. Pictures dare the world not to remember by appearing in disguise, as if the subjects of the pictures dare the world not to remember by appearing in disguise, as if to deny that anything can fix them, own them, know them. In his Little History of Photography, Walter Benjamin speaks of a photograph made in 1840 by the British painter David Octavius Hill. He made his photographs as aids to his real art, painting. And today he's remembered as a photographer, and he's utterly forgotten as a painter. And Benjamin is talking about a photo titled New Haven Fishwife. In this picture, Benjamin says, with her eyes cast down in such indolent, seductive modesty, there remains something that goes beyond the testimony of the photographer's art, something that cannot be silenced, that fills you with an unruly desire to know what her name was, the woman who was alive there, who even now is still real and will never consent to be wholly absorbed by anything we call art. I lived, Benjamin, here's the woman in this photograph saying. I was here. If you are walking in New Haven now, you are walking in my footsteps. Something that cannot be silenced. Benjamin is refusing to let this person die. But we know that all photographs of people are photographs of death, even if the people in the photos are not dead as we look. We know that someday someone will look at this picture and wonder who it was. To photograph someone is not to steal their soul. It's to raise the question of whether the person will be forgotten, of becoming absolutely lost to history, even in his or her own family. As the family pictures pass down through the generations, one by one, and one day a child points at an old crumbling photograph and says, "Who was that?" And nobody knows. Is anything lost by Sinead O'Connor turning her back on us? Her face is beautiful, but she can blank it out like other people close their eyes. Her eyes speak through the back of her head in this picture. She's saying we'll know as much about her by seeing her from behind as we ever will by looking her in the face. Look at the fingers. The nails are bitten down to the quick. There's a scar or a cut on one finger. She's comfortable with the idea that she will be lost to history. Her whole career has in its way been a test of whether one can live her life in invisibility, or live her life in public and remain invisible to anyone who looks at her. But nothing like that could ever be said about this next face. Can we look at the next picture? Now, if you can see through that mask, if you can not flinch from the eyes that flash their anger, even through dark glasses, and if you can recognize Chuck Berry just a year out of prison in 1964, then you can tell him that there's no certainty that he will be remembered as long as anything is worth remembering. And he can tell the rest of us that he could care less what we remember. Thank you for being here. It's been a great privilege to talk tonight. If you have any questions, if you have any disagreements, if you have any thoughts of your own, I'd be really delighted to respond. Thank you. Maybe the lights could go up, so if somebody raises their hand, I can see it. Well, I guess not. Maybe someone can just speak up. Okay, that's better. Yeah. Well, you know, he is an anonymous collector, and he will remain anonymous. Yes, I'm sorry. I was asked, is this anonymous collector someone who we would all know? And and I won't even go that far. But, you know, it is an act of modesty. This is someone who wants the pictures looked at, not himself talked about. The question is, most of the photos in the exhibition are black and white. And is there a feeling that black and white is more honest? Is it more real? I guess that's what you're asking. And I don't think there's any question. I think most photographers certainly believe that. That, you know, photography is about light, it's about shadows, it's about contrast. And you can manipulate black and white. You can manipulate those things. You make a photograph. I mean, a photograph is not taken so much as it's made. People used to speak of a song being made, not just written. It was an object to be created. Something that didn't exist in the world before now exists in the world. And that sense is true of photography, too. I think there is a sense with color. Look, we're taking a picture of the world as it actually is, or we're pretending we're taking a picture of the world as it actually is. With a black and white picture, we are creating a picture of the way we want something to look. It's patently not the way things really look, unless we're colorblind. And people who are colorblind don't see in black and white anyway. So it is, you know, that is where the art is in photography. I don't have any doubt about that. Yeah. Sure. The question is, if a big art museum puts on a rock and roll photography show, is it still rock and roll? And absolutely it is. You know, it's just a question. A lot of it has to do with what you bring to it. If you walk into a museum and somehow you're intimidated or you're brought down by the notion that suddenly these things... well, look, there's a wonderful line in a Bob Dylan song, "Inside the museum's infinity goes up on trial." Yes, it's on trial. You're the jury. You decide, is it still rock and roll? I can't answer that for you. It certainly is for me. Way in the back. Well, I was reading Rolling Stone, like anybody else, and I went one day, I was walking down the street in Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, and I passed Record City, the record store I would go to, and there was an album, The Who on Tour. Oh, fantastic. All Who fans, this was 1968, all Who fans wanted a live album. The Who on Tour obviously was a live album. I went in, I paid my $1.99, I took it home, I put it on. It was not a live album. I'd been suckered. I'd been tricked. I was angry. So I sat down and I wrote a review of this album, which was mainly a review of what it could have been, what it should have been. And I mailed it in, and a week later, there it was. And I thought, this is really easy. So that was the first review I ever wrote.
But it did have Magic Box.
It had lots of great things on it, but not the right things. You know, this was a fan talking. Yeah. The question is, do I think the staff of Rolling Stone today still feels the urge to document history? You know, if the people who were putting out the magazine today, including Jan Wenner, who was putting it out from the beginning because it was his invention, if they feel that way, it's a different kind of history. It's a matter of, particularly in their political writing, which is often terrific, it's a matter of setting the story straight, of you know, getting the scales off of your eyes, stripping away the veils of illusions, where earlier it was a matter of making a secret public. You don't know who this person is, but we're going to print this picture this way so you're going to want to know who this person is, because you ought to know who this person is, because he has things to tell you, because he's making sounds that no one else is making. So it's a different kind of history. That's a really interesting question. Are many musicians, or any musicians, photographers in their own right, and is there work in the exhibition? I'm not sure that there is any such work in the exhibition. Bruce Conner used to play a harmonica, but I don't know if that really counts. I really can't answer that. I don't know. Does anyone else know? Patti Smith has a book of her own photographs out. Who? Who's Mill Penton? I guess the answer is yes. I know almost none of the people that I've written about over the years, personally. I've met a few. There are very, very few people I've met and who I've become friends with. And you know, when you're friends with somebody, you if you get any glimmer, the question was, I'm sorry, I should be repeating all the questions. The question was, I know many of my subjects of my own writing personally. Have I seen them change over the years? Have I seen them change because of money or fame or maybe failure or whatever? And I was just saying that I don't know most or hardly any of the people I write about. There are a few people I become friends with. You become friends with somebody, you know them at least to some degree, and you accept them for who they are, and you don't judge them, and you don't perceive changes that might be apparent to other people because the person is still there, unless there's some terrible betrayal or some breach after which you said, well, he's completely changed, he's worthless now, he used to be such a good guy. But one of the reasons why I've met almost none of the people I've written about is I got some very, very good advice when I first started writing. One of the founding editors of Rolling Stone was a man named Ralph Gleason, who for many years was the pop music and more importantly, jazz music critic of the San Francisco Chronicle starting in the 1940s. I grew up reading him. And by the time I began to have these urges to write myself, it seemed that everything Ralph Gleason wrote was unbelievably tired and boring. He wrote 6 columns a week, and I was sure he had 3 columns. And he rewrote those columns over and over and over again. So in the first 2 or 3 pieces I ever published after that first record review I was asked about, there were digs at Ralph Gleason. Really, you know, unkind, snotty digs. And I wrote a piece about the coasters, and we needed an illustration for it. And I was told, You know, Ralph Gleason has pictures of everybody. You call up Ralph Gleason, he'll give you a picture of the poster of the coasters. I thought, uh-oh. So I called him up. He invited me over to his house. He let me in. He made one quiet comment that let me know he'd read what I had written about him. And then he sat me down and he talked to me for the next 3 hours about the music business and what it meant to be a writer in the music business. And he said, don't meet the people you write about. He said, people will try and get you to meet them. Record company people will try and introduce you to these people. They'll want you to go out and have dinner with them. They'll want you to hang around backstage. They'll invite you to recording sessions. And the reason they're doing this is because they want you to see that these are nice people. They're friendly. They're intelligent, they're warm, and they are going to show you the wonderful qualities of these people, so you will never write anything bad about them. You will feel terrible if they put out an absolutely awful record and you say so you won't. He said, that's all it's about. Don't ever trust a musician. Of course, Ralph Gleason was friends with dozens and dozens of musicians, deep friends, soul friends, people who trusted him, who relied on him as much as he admired them. But I took his advice to heart. And it was good advice. Yeah. Well, the question is, are there people who I have great respect for as artists who never got the recognition that they deserved? I think of Arlene Smith. She was the singer in a group called the Chantels in the late 50s, a doo-wop group. And I, you know, probably heard her in the 50s on the radio, but it didn't necessarily make any impression on me. And I think it was in 1969 I discovered an old album of the Chantels in a used record store, and I took it home and I played it, and I immediately called up all my best friends and said, you've got to get over here and you've got to hear this now. And one of my friends, also a writer, described her voice as beginning where Aretha ends. She had the biggest, most commanding, most desperate voice in all of rock and roll. And she was 15 years old at the time in this group. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Cadillac Ranch. There's a Cadillac Ranch. I'm thinking of the Bruce Springsteen song. Cadillac Records, the story of Chess Records. And there's a scene in it where Leonard Chess, played by Adrian Brody, is trying to get Etta James, played by Beyoncé, to sing a song called Church Bells May Ring. And she's not getting it. It's not getting off the ground. She's done it over and over again. And he finally says to her, okay, everybody go home. We're going to stop this. He says to her, you can't sing this song. This is a waste of time. He says, you're not woman enough for this song. She says, well, I am too. He says, you know, you don't even understand this song. This is about somebody who's dumped you, who's left you behind, and you're seeing that. He says, you've never experienced anything like that. You've never experienced anything. And he's winking at Muddy Waters off to the side while he's going through this charade. But Etta James is buying every minute of it, and she's getting angrier and more miserable and more full of herself. And finally, just as Leonard Chess is about to walk out of the room, he says, oh, okay, do it one more time, because he knows that's the take that will stick. George Goldner was the producer of the Chantels in 1958, and he told a story just before he died about how he got her greatest recording. It's a recording called If You Try. It was never released as a single. It was buried on this album. And he said, I made her cry. I beat her up. He didn't mean physically. I would swear at her. I would curse at her. He said she was a convent girl. She was 15 years old. And here was this big, ugly, mean man. And she couldn't get home to her parents. And there was no one to help her. And I reduced her to tears. I did violence to her. And then I said, oh, all right, do it one more time. And that's how he got what he was looking for, what he knew was there, what he knew was in her. She didn't get the recognition she deserves. She made some records, they were hits, and then she went back to real life. That's an honorable thing to do. But I think of somebody else. And again, you know, maybe the question is kind of skewed, because what do people want when they make records? Do they want fame? Do they want recognition? Do they want money? Or do they want to say something in a way that no one else has said before? Do they want to speak a different language? Do they want to put something into the world that wasn't there before, and something that somehow, some way, will never disappear? I think of a singer named Gishi Wiley. Nobody knows anything about this person except that she unquestionably lived. She made 6 recordings in 1930 and 1931. She was female. She was black. She was probably born sometime around 1900. It's a real good bet that she's dead today, but nobody really knows. She made a recording in 1930 called Last Kind Word Blues. And there's never been a recording anything like it. It is one of the most mystical, one of the quietest, one of the most deep sea of all blues recordings. And the scariest thing about it, I read just the other day, someone is saying, this record cannot have been a fluke. In other words, we don't know what else she had in her. We don't know if she could have described a whole continent in her songs. We just have this one song that stands out from the others she recorded, but this one song does describe whole continents of life and death, of feeling, of despair and longing, of suffering and triumph over suffering in a bare 3 minutes. So this is a person who I believe, down through the decades, will be recognized more and more. And it could be that in 200 years, people will talk about Gishi Wiley and this one song as if, of course, Gishi Wiley, but we don't today. And thank you. Thank you.